Welcome to As I Live and Grieve, a podcast that tells the truth about how hard this is. We're glad you joined us today. We know how hard it is to lose someone you love and how well-intentioned friends and family try so hard to comfort us. We created this podcast to provide you with comfort, knowledge, and support. We are grief advocates, not professionals, not licensed therapists. We are you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back again to As I Live and Grieve. You hear me say it every week. It's no different. Never will be. My guest this week is so much fun. You're going to love listening to her and pay special attention when she talks about her book, because this is the one book you have got to get or gift it to someone you know. So without further ado, hi, Deb Weiss, and welcome to our podcast.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. And again, your book, I'm having so much fun reading it. I really am. So before we get started talking more about your book and that part of your personal story, why don't you just start us out and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you. Well, I grew up in a small suburban town in Northern California. My mother died. My first experience with grief was shortly before I was 10. My mom died. That was about 1973. So I grew up with an amazing single dad, and I was an only child. So that all that was fine. I'm probably a little maladjusted because I became a lawyer, and I married my high school sweetheart. His name was George. I'd known him since I was 7. Our parents worked together. His mom and my dad were both scientists. And they knew each other. So I met George when he was 11 and I was 7. And then we started dating when I was a high school senior. And we had a very good life together for 32 years. But in about 2009, he was diagnosed with metastasized male breast cancer. George was a workaholic. And like many men, he sort of put his health and what concerned him on the back burner. Sure. We had a few more good years together. But about the fall of 2012, he started to get sick, and he passed on April 10th of 2013.
So sorry, as always. And having lost my husband, I know that there could be a lot of different types of grief, but losing someone, especially the two of you knowing each other since childhood, it had to have been just absolutely devastating.
It was. He was my best friend. Neither of us were very social. I retired from practicing law at 40. He was really an introverted engineer. He was pretty happy being in front of a computer. So we were pretty isolated. We were each other's best friends. We did everything together. I didn't have like a real support network. Again, I'm an only child. He was an only child.
Is it fair to say that he was your whole life?
It is. It's very fair. At that point, he pretty much was. He was then.
So here you are, and we know, because we all do it, we get through the death, we get through the calling hours, we get through the burial or a cremation, we get through all of that because we have no choice. No one asked us if we wanted to do that. We get through that, and then at some point, the realization comes to us that now it's just us. How was that part of grief for you?
Not good. George had been in denial about his illness. So he thought he was getting better, but he was clearly dying. And that made things very difficult. He didn't involve his parents. He turned down things that would have helped, like home health care and palliative care. We never had a real goodbye. So, you know, first when he died, I was really numb. I think maybe a lot of people are. And there was a lot of things to do. So I could do that. I could go into lawyer mode. But then at some point, you know, especially at night, I'd realize I am alone. And we'd always woken up together, right? You eat dinner together. You go to sleep together. You have touch together. And then suddenly you're just at least I was just by myself. I don't have children. My house was just empty. And I was not good. I was having anxiety attacks. You know, if you met me, I seemed real strong. But somehow at night I turned back into, you know, a 10-year-old. Where's mom? Where's George?
Right. Nighttime's the hardest, I think, when you're newly grieving, especially. That's the hardest when you're used to turning to someone else, even for casual conversation or a light touch or that hug or that brief kiss goodnight. Absolutely. At what point was it then that you decided you just couldn't or didn't want to do this anymore by yourself, and you decided to try dating? What was your mindset? How did that happen?
Well, I think people should be honest about making mistakes when they grieve. And about 4 months after George died, I got into a bad relationship with someone who had been his caregiver, who was a lot younger. If you've read the book, you'll know. And that ended. But I did realize I wanted to be with someone. At that point, I was 14 months after he died. I had things in order. I'd been through the bad relationship. I'd even thrown out prematurely all my alcohol for 6 weeks. I was like, I'm going to do this with a straight mind. Got it all back, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was 50 and in good health. I was lonely. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see what it was like to meet people. I'd married my high school sweetheart. I hadn't dated since I was 16. That was in 1980.
Right.
Yeah, 1980. So I thought, well, you know, let's try. I was feeling that, you know, I thought I was strong enough to venture out. You know, the idea, I didn't want to spend the rest of my life alone. I wanted to find someone.
Okay. So it sounds like you didn't really have like a close friend that you could say, hey, do you know any guys that are single or anything? So you turned to dating apps?
I did. I turned to dating apps, specifically JDate, which was a dating app for Jewish people, which I figured might be a little tamer and a little less crazy.
Yeah.
Which it was, but it didn't have a huge group of people. You know, I actually did try to meet people in real life because I was out. But it was funny. Like, I joined my local synagogue and I figured somebody would have, you know, a nice divorced son or cousin. And I was surprised when the women were all like, well, good for you for getting out there. We wish our kids would. You know, but nobody seemed to really have like a feasible person for me to meet, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, I lived, you know, in a pretty small suburban town. So that seemed the best option.
Okay. And yes, I am reading your book and mm-hmm. I'm finding it an absolute, well, I know it's a book about your grief, so I'll apologize in advance, but your book is a hoot.
Thank you.
It's just the thing someone going through grief needs to read, especially, I might say, if that person is also considering dating, because your descriptions, your stories about your dates, I just loved. I loved your thoughts and everything. And I loved how you wanted to rewrite their profiles too, because I think you hit that spot on. So how did the dating go then?
Terrible. It was awful. You know, part of it, in fairness, part of it was my ignorance. Since I hadn't dated when I was like college age or in my 30s, I kind of wasn't maybe aware of some of the red flags and things that women who'd been single later in life might see in someone who's an allegedly an adult man. So,
like,
you know,
what?
Well, people like the one guy in the book, people who are obsessed with their exes. People who hadn't moved on from whatever their divorce story, whatever their own disturbances were, and were very angry. You know, I seem to meet a lot of men who are angry at women in general and angry at life in general and felt like somehow they were owed something and they were going to take it out on the female race. The amount of effort, the lack of effort people put into this stuff was ridiculous. And a lot of them were too forward for my taste. I'm pretty old-fashioned. I tried to work with not being old-fashioned, which was, I think, pretty funny in the book because I was trying to be like outside my comfort zone. And I discovered that, you know, ultimately I was pretty happy with my old comfort zone. I tried being, you know, more modern. I don't know that that worked for me.
Yeah. Did you, with each person you met, do you feel that you were getting an education, so to speak?
I do feel I was getting an education. I do. Because I hadn't known a lot of people in my life and been with a lot of men. And I thought men were supposed to be nicer, you know, because I mean, my dad was an amazing person, an amazing single parent. Mm-hmm. My mom, again, died when I was 10. So I saw him dating when I was in my teens. And he was always nice to the women and courteous and pleasant, you know, and chivalrous even. And George was certainly a wonderful person to everybody. He was couples I knew growing up. I mean, they weren't like these schmucks. I don't know where these people came from. I don't know what happened. And I hope their moms are kind of ashamed of them.
Oh, good point. I like that. Did it get any better?
Yes and no. It got better because at one point I lowered my expectations and I went, you know what? I am like practically a 49-year-old virgin. I mean, I'd been with one man my whole life. I hadn't dated since I was 16 and I was a pretty nerdy kid, so that didn't count for much. And I was just like, okay, I'm a writer. I'm just going to see what this is like. And I was very cautious, but I would meet people who, you know, might not be the right person for me. I would just think, it's coffee. It's fun to talk.
Sure.
And it was kind of unintentionally comedic. I mean, these people were funnier than things I could write. You know, if you go through the book, everything's true. I'm not an imaginative person that way. And it was like, who the flip are these people? Where do they come from? So it got better because my expectations were lowered. But it also got worse because I felt jaded. And I felt disgusted. And again, some guys were forward or they were rude. Or, you know, you put something out on a dating site and you get responses that range from disrespectful to rape culture, in my opinion. And that's unacceptable. So at some point, I was starting to feel a little tarnished, you know?
Yeah.
A little used up.
Yeah. Are you still using the dating app today? Are you still dating?
Well, I know. Thank you for asking. For 4.5 years, I have been with my current partner. I did find a good person. It took me 5 years.
5 years.
Now, I was off sometimes, but, you know, it...
Yeah.
5 years.
Well, I'm glad you took an occasional break because when I hear that someone has lowered their expectations, so to speak, that's... I think we as women do that a lot. Because it's too hard, and we certainly can't change someone else. So when it appears that the odds are stacked against you, yet you still would like to have an occasional cup of coffee or an occasional dinner, sometimes we do tend to lower our expectations. But did you finally meet your Mr. Right on JDate?
You know, I went through a whole bunch of other sites. People... JDate didn't really have enough people, and I'm more culturally Jewish. I'm not a particularly religious in that way. I just thought there might be some affinities in terms of things like overprotective parents and loving bagels.
Right.
But I went through a few apps and settled on OkCupid because it seemed to have more people in closer to me in Northern California, more aligned with my personal beliefs, and the profiles were more detailed. Again, I personally, if I'm looking for a life partner, I want someone who's taken some time to fill something out, you know.
Right.
You know,
right,
I like sunsets and surfing isn't real helpful. But ironically, I wound up with someone who had a profile like that. I was on Cupid one morning and I had a picture of myself on the site where I was wearing these tennis shoes with skulls on them. And I had got an email that said, "Are those Vans with skulls on them?" I answered, "Yes, they are." Answered back, "Oh, well, those are cool. I think I'm going to get a pair." Nobody had talked about shoes before. I worried this was a foot fetishist, but...
he just liked shoes.
He did. He's a fashion sense. And we just started, we started texting a bit, and he was very pleasant. And yes, 4.5 years later, we moved in together last year.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. I'm so happy to hear that. So at what point did you say, this has been an incredible 4 or 5 years, I have to write a book? How did that come to pass?
Well, I've always loved writing. I was an English major. I became a lawyer because I wanted something employable. I've been taking a writing class at an adult education center that met once a week when George became ill and I stopped going. I couldn't write about chemo and things.
No.
Didn't have the bandwidth. But after he passed, about 6 months, I started to take some writing classes again and got in a writing group with some wonderful people from my writing class. And that saved me because twice a week at this point, I had something to do that was passionate about with wonderful, lovely people who were friendly to me and inclusive. and brought me into their writing group. I remember sitting in my friend's apartment who held the group. She became a friend in a chintz chair with her little dog and tea, and we're talking about our writing. And I was like, this is healing. You know, sometimes the things that are healing for us aren't the things that are traditionally healing, but that was for me, mm-hmm. that was healing. Dana, right. If you're listening to this, I love you. And from there, I got more serious. I guess I'm a little bit competitive. I started to submit things to publications, and I blogged on the Huffington Post about grief, about what it was like.
Right.
And submitted stuff, and then eventually went a little crazy and went back to school to get a master's of fine arts in writing. I went back to college and got a 2-year mm-hmm. master's degree and to workshop the book. And I thought and got an editor. I just started to put things together and I decided, let's see what happened. And then I would get more serious and I could tell that mm-hmm. the book wasn't at a quality level that what I would call a real book by a real writer. So, you know, again, I hired an editor and I workshopped it and kept going. So it just kind of gradually happened.
Well, I'm fascinated with the book. I really am. And I read, for every guest we have who's an author, I always read their book. Some I make it all the way through, some not quite so much, and others may just not be for me. Sure. But your book is so easy to read, I have to say. And the way you inject humor, it keeps me from sobbing, I think, because other times when you talk about your relationship with your husband, I would be sobbing because it's so tender and so loving. But then you throw in something about dating, you kind of go back and forth. And it's just absolutely hilarious. I think in personality wise, or just, you know, the way the words we like, I think you and I have some parallels, because it's sounds exactly like something I would do. A little bit of seriousness here, and then, oh, let's throw in something funny just to keep people from losing their minds. But your book's title is Available As Is.
It is.
A Midlife's Widow to...
A Midlife Widow's Search for Love.
Midlife Widow's Search for Love. Okay, a couple of things. Available As Is. Why did you pick that for a title?
Well, my publisher helped with that, honestly. My book was originally called Widowland because being widow to me felt very isolated and mm-hmm. isolating. But apparently there is a dystopian young adult novel that's doing quite well, probably better than my book with the same name. So I had to come up with something else. And I loved Available As Is because as older singles, we're like older real estate. We're available as is with our flaws, with our quirks, with mm-hmm. our, you know, probably poundage of emotional baggage. You know, mm-hmm. I thought it really fit what we're like as older people. We are available as is. And especially those of us who, you know, are content to be getting older.
Okay. Is that really what you thought of yourself? Was that you were as is, no room for repair? Or, you know, kind of that, when you think about cars, buying a used car, available as is, you know, a lot of miles, just kind of worn out. You didn't think of yourself that way. I didn't get that impression in the book.
Oh, I didn't feel that way at all.
Okay, good.
I felt very open to change because I had lived such an insular, isolated life with my husband. I knew I had to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, I thought I was really socially awkward. So I started to go to everything. Like I had my late husband's sports car. So I joined the car club. I joined the Rotary club. And one thing, you know, what I discovered was people were overall very nice. It was awkward being a widow, but overall people were nice. I didn't have any social deficits in particular. I was just shy. Everything was fine. And, you know, and I had to be open to change. And traveling by myself, my late husband hadn't wanted to travel. Well, I wasn't going to end my life without at least trying to travel, see if I mm-hmm. liked it. I'm a homebody, but yeah. So I was very open to change. I honestly wasn't available as is, except for things like, you know, one guy pleasantly said I would be perfect if only I get breast implants. And that really wasn't something I was interested in. So physically, I was kind of as is, but I was pretty open to change. What I found ironic were that most of the men I met were not open to change. You know, I met these guys. I've been single for 20 years. I wish I'd find somebody. I'm really miserable. Hey, by the way, can you pay for your own dinner? And I don't open doors. And it's like, well, you could change a little bit, right? You know, I found a lot of these people, just these really self-defeating patterns that didn't change. I was actually quite open to change. I mean, I changed a lot. I couldn't have talked to people or done things like this podcast when I was still a married person. I didn't reach out. You know, so yeah, I changed a lot.
Yeah, that was my sense, that it was almost a tongue-in-cheek title, which I appreciated very much. I also appreciated the midlife phrase, because midlife would indicate, if you were in your 50s, that, you know, that's the middle of life. I personally am shooting for 100 years of age before I die. So that would be my midlife as well. And I used to tell people when I went through a horrible, horrible divorce. But in fact, it took me 12 years to find him, to be able to divorce him. But I used to call that the long, dark middle of my life. Wow. It was very, very difficult. But it's nice that we go through that. And I think at some point we make a conscious decision, and then we start using intentions, and we start saying, I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't want to live this way anymore. And we decide that we're going to do something or some things to kind of turn it around, because enough is enough. Now, we don't think, we, my daughter and I, and others we've talked to and had as guests, we don't think that you ever get over grief.
No, you don't.
You move on. You move on. Mm-hmm. Because you have no choice again. I mean, life is going to go on with or without you.
Right.
So you can either be miserable, sit on your couch day after day and wail and moan and gnash your teeth and the whole thing. Or you can at some point say, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore. And you can start living by intention. Would you agree that that's kind of what happened for you?
Yes, it was. It was something, yes, that did happen. Yes, I was miserable at first, and I was very angry that George had died, and also for the way he put me through his death process would have been far better if he wasn't in denial. And I had to forgive him, because it's a mental, it was a mental breakdown, I believe.
Absolutely.
He never meant to hurt me. I mean, that's pretty clear in the book.
No.
I had to forgive myself for being angry from that process. And I had to look back that most of my marriage, unlike a lot of people, I'm very lucky, it was very loving and supportive and nurturing. And I had to look at that and say, okay, you can be miserable or you can be not, but that's your choice. I do a lot of yoga, which is very big on intention. You know, you sign up for class, you intend to go. Right. And I had to kind of intend not to be bitter and ultimately to have some measure of gratitude. I find that I'm rhyming. I hate that, a platitude, because, well, you know, you're grieving and people go, well, you should be grateful for the time you had. You should be grateful you're still alive. And it's like, you don't know. But I had to kind of say, look, you know, I had enough resources that I could look into traveling. I had my home.
Right.
I could do things. I was healthy. I had to say, okay, you can be really unhappy for the rest of your life, or you can look for joy. I mean, I'm very lucky I didn't have to go back to looking for insurance coverage to keep my
There you go.
I was an insurance coverage lawyer. So
okay.
I had to look at things of saying, you have agency.
Right.
It isn't like something that just happened to you. Mm-hmm. You have to have intention to find joy and to be grateful that you have the opportunity to do that.
Exactly. Exactly. So, do you miss your husband?
Good question. Sometimes still. Mm-hmm. Not terribly often, because he was a workaholic and he loved the computer. And I discovered later that the things he loved to do, I don't so much. You know, he drove all over the San Francisco Bay Area, getting these complicated ingredients and making these amazing meals. And I'm not that into it. That's not something, but I miss his spirit. I miss his heart. I love him dearly. What helps me not to miss him, I'm gonna cry, is my new partner and I are both friends with him.
Oh.
He's an absolute friend to us. I know that sounds like a twisty thing, but Randall, my current partner, he loves George too. We have a lot of things from my old home and our marriage. Not everything. I got rid of a ton, but things mm-hmm. in our home. We'll go out to celebrate his birthday and get an ice cream sundae because George loved a good ice cream sundae. We talk mm-hmm. about him. So when I miss him, I can talk about him. So I feel a little bit that the memories, you know, I don't feel a ghost, although I have had a few ghostly experiences, which is weird because mm-hmm. I'm not a believer in that way. But right. I feel like the good parts are still with us in some ways.
Well, I loved your story before, but now I'm in love with you and your new life as well.
Oh, thank you.
That for me was the missing puzzle piece. Not so much that Randall was also a friend and knew George, but the fact that you're able to talk about George when you need to, you're able to celebrate him when you need to, that for me denotes a wonderful relationship. It really does.
And yeah, Randall I'm never so happy. Knew George. George okay. He didn't know him. They never okay. met. George died in 2013, and I met Randall okay. in 2018. I met okay. him, I think, in
but he's come to know him. He's come to know him, and he's been accepting. He's been accepting of the fact. Well, Randall's a wonderful guy.
Well, I'll hang on to him. I will. I'll tell him you said so.
Hang on to him because you know that that kind of man is few and far between.
Yeah, it was very odd. I mean, being a widow dating is odd because people will say, well, you're not going to get what you've had with your late husband. And it's like, okay, I mean, I don't need to be exactly the same, but in terms of someone who has good manners and thinks of women as people, I don't think that should be that hard to find, you know? But people were kind of intimidated by a long marriage and seemed to kind of tell me, well, that's not something you can ever have again. And I thought, well, why can't you have that again?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So my last question for you, and then I'm going to turn the mic over to you a little bit. Does Randall meet your higher expectations or your lower expectations?
I would say my higher expectations. I mean,
it sounds like it.
He really did. Our first real date mm-hmm. was a 12-hour drive when he went an hour out of his way to pick me up in his old convertible.
Oh my gosh.
And we drove around and, you know, one of our other dates was a beautiful weekend in Carmel mm-hmm. because he wanted me to appreciate it again. Because I'd driven there by myself. It was so lonely without George. I'd driven home the same day.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he took me there and we weren't dating long at that point. We got separate rooms and he said, I want you to enjoy this again. And he read all my writing, which I had a lot of stuff out. So my expectations were exceeded. I was amazed to find so much joy again because, you know, I hated dating after a while and I started to use a real basic criteria, which is, am I looking forward to this or am I not?
I like
and
that.
And I was always looking forward to seeing
Randall. I like that. Check your frame of mind. Good, mm-hmm. good one. I think I might use that in some other aspects of my life, actually. So is some of the volunteer efforts I do, am I looking forward to this or, interesting. Yeah. Okay, so now it's your turn. I'm going to turn the mic over to you, Debbie. And I want you to tell our listeners about your book more specifically. Repeat the title to them. Tell them anything you want to about it, but especially where they can get it. Because, you know, the holidays are coming and it's a great gift.
And it's funny you should say that because I've been hearing that from a few actually younger people. So start at the beginning. My book is called Available As Is, A Midlife Widow's Search for Love, which also encompasses self-love. The book is available everywhere, actually, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and you can order it or it's on the shelves. I found one of it on the bottom shelf in a little bookstore in the wine country in the Napa area.
Nice.
But you can order it from indie bookstores because that's really important. I live in Benicia and the bookstore shop here in Benicia has been so supportive. So plug for indie bookstores.
Absolutely.
As has the bookstore in Danville where I grew up. So it's available everywhere. It is on the easiest place, though, for people like me who don't go out that much or I read on a Kindle is Amazon. And the Kindle is 99 cents. Since I'm a new author, I want people to read it. So Kindle is virtually free at 99 cents. It's about trying to create a new life after having been in an all-encompassing marriage for 32 years, having gone from my dad's house to moving in with George. And it's about trying to create a new life as a midlife widow and all aspects of that, trying to connect with people and also dating, which is kind of the heart of it, because who doesn't want to find love again? But it was also about finding myself at midlife and trying to create a life from being very isolated. I have heard from some folks that they think it's a good book for their moms, especially who are widowed younger people. Yeah. because it is about like getting out there and creating a new life after widowhood. So I have heard from folks that it would make a good book. And people I've heard are giving it to widowed friends who are leery of venturing out again. But again, the title is available as is. I'm hearing really good things about it. It has a great Kirkus review. It has endorsements by best-selling authors. And I've been hearing great stuff from people other than my dad and Randall. Other people have liked it.
Great. Is there a second book on the way?
I don't think so. Your book is for this show is for grievers, but honestly, the publishing process, I have regular distribution. I went to a publisher that I paid for, a hybrid mm-hmm. publisher. And right. you have to do publicity and things. And all this is not cost effective. It's too expensive. And I don't like a lot of the social media stuff. It ain't for me. I can do it. I've got a good Facebook page, Debbie Weiss Author. But personally, the book promotion is pretty soul deadening. And in my mm-hmm. next life, I'm coming back as a yoga teacher.
All right.
That might be my next okay. endeavor. I don't, if I did anything again, it would be something small, self-published and self-help. If this book were successful, I would just put stuff out there that I thought might be helpful to folks. It was also, if you're not a writer, you don't know this. It's very hard to create a book with character and depth and a sense of place. And I tried very hard because it's long, 280 pages, to make the book read like fiction, to make it interesting to a reader. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't just, I did this. And that was hard. And I worked with a very good editor, but I don't know that I would do that process again. It's pretty rigorous.
I understand that completely. Also, as a writer, I'm working on my second book. My first one was a memoir, a focused memoir of about 3 years of my life. And I understand that the editing process is very painful. And one of my favorite writing quotes is that, and I can't even remember now who said it, but I like to have written.
Yes.
When it's all over, I feel great. Yeah. But the process is very painful. And when you're writing about something that personally was very raw and you feel very vulnerable and that you're exposing yourself, and it can be even more painful. Okay, sadly, Debbie, it is time now for us to sign off. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed chatting with you. I'm going to finish your book. Again, listeners, if you like to gift books, and that's always one of my go-to gifts, because people read it and then they pass it on and they pass it on and they pass it on. And I just love that whole aspect of it. This is a great book. It's not at all a difficult read. You will love the humor in it. You will actually double over in laughter at her comments about some of her dates. They are absolutely hilarious. And I know that I probably would have had some of those very same thoughts. So check it out. As she says, the Kindle, I mean, come on, 99 cents. And, I know some people even share Kindle, but, the hard copy is not that expensive either. It makes a great gift. So until next week, everyone, remember to take care of yourself. We always talk about self-care. I liken it to that little speech they give you on the airplane. If the oxygen masks drop out of the roof, then, put yours on first. Because if you don't take care of yourself, you can't effectively take care of someone else. Very important. Take care of yourselves. Stay well. I love every single one of you, wherever you are in the world. And please come back again next week as we all continue to live in grief.
Thank you so much for listening with us today. Do you have a topic that you'd like us to cover, or do you have a question from one of our episodes? Please email us at info@asiliveandgrieve.com and let us know. We hope you will find a moment to leave a review, send an email, and share with others. Join us next time as we continue to live and grieve together.